Hello, and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for the week of June 6th, 2019. This week on the podcast, we're focusing on the 75th anniversary of D-Day, the Allied landings in Normandy, France, which happened 75 years ago this week on June 6th, 1944, and most famously portrayed in the film Steven Spielberg's 1998 movie Saving Private Ryan. To talk about this anniversary, the D-Day landings themselves, and what they meant then and now, my special guest this week is our very own Dr. Todd Gross. Todd is the president and CEO of the Georgia Historical Society, where he has been for almost 25 years. Todd is an expert on military history, the Civil War, and leadership. He holds an undergraduate degree in history from the University of Memphis and a master's and PhD in history from the University of Tennessee. Todd is a published scholar and author of several books on the Civil War and on public history. His first book, entitled Mountain Rebels, East Tennessee Confederates and the Civil War, was based on his doctoral dissertation and published by the University of Tennessee Press in 1999. In 2005, he co-edited with Steve Ashe a book entitled 19th Century America, Essays in Honor of Paul Bergeron, also published by UT Press. And I should note that Dr. Bergeron, the noted scholar of Andrew Johnson, was Todd's dissertation director and advisor at UT. Todd has written over 75 articles, essays, and book reviews for publications ranging from the New York Times to the Journal of Southern History. As you might expect, he does a lot of public speaking on all manner of subjects related to the Civil War, leadership, and military history. Now, as you'll hear in our discussion, Todd and I have had many informal discussions through the years about all kinds of events and people in history, and I thought it might be fun to invite him to be on this podcast to share his insights on D-Day. The interview was recorded in his office in the Jepson House Education Center in Savannah on June 3rd, 2019. I hope you enjoy it. Todd, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Stan. Glad to be here.
Todd and I spend a great deal of time, much to our colleague's chagrin, talking history around the office, both talking about the not only events in history, but what they mean in our own time. And so I thought it would be fun if we actually did this for the fun for us, and of course, much to the chagrin of our listeners, for us to talk about this anniversary that's coming up this Thursday, which is the 75th anniversary of D-Day. With your wide knowledge of World War II and military history, I thought it would be great fun and entertaining and instructive for us to talk about what exactly happened on D-Day and its larger meaning both at the time for World War II and going forward into our own day. So why don't we start out by just talking very broadly about what happened on D-Day, June 6, 1944.
Well, let's talk first about what D-Day was. There were many D-Days in World War II. Basically, what D meant was day. So it was a way of marking when exactly the invasion would take place. So D-Day was the, basically what it stood for was day-day. So D minus or plus certain number of days would be the days before and after D-Day. So D plus 5 would be 5 days after the landing day, which was June the 6th, 1944. H hour was the hour when the landing would take place, which in that case was 0630. So anything measured before and after that. So if you said H plus so many hours, that would tell you how long after the 630 the first assault went in. So there were many D-Days in World War II. The D-Day we tend to think about, D-Day being June the 6th, 1944, this vast invasion of Europe, the beginning of the liberation of Western Europe. But there were many amphibious assaults during World War II. In fact, the men that were on their way to Saipan during that same time period to begin the operation that would take Saipan and Guam and Tinian, which was a turning point in the Pacific, heard about the amphibious assault into Normandy, and they were very nonplussed by the whole thing. They were like, so that's nice, we've got our own operation coming up. So we tend to, we've looked back on it and turned it into like the amphibious assault of World War II, but in fact at the time it was one of many. Not to take anything away from it, because it was an extremely important point in which there was the opening of the much vaunted and much looked for Second Front that would then help to crush the German army between the Russians in the east and the British and the American allies coming up in the west.
And so do you think that one of the reasons that it gets so much attention is because this was, in fact, taking the war right into the Nazis for the first time, as opposed to out in the Pacific where it's sort of hard to follow what exactly is going on? This is the liberation of Europe.
Well, the strategy had been the British were not wanting to open a second front in this way. The Americans had been pushing this idea since 1942, almost as soon as we got into it, as soon as we could get troops into the European theater, into England, we wanted to begin and open the second front. And we were getting a lot of pressure from Stalin to open this second front, because remember, he's bearing the brunt of the German attack. I mean, there are hundreds of divisions that are going into the Soviet Union. And he wants this second front. He, Stalin, wants this open so that it can take some pressure off of the Russians.
He'd been fighting the Germans alone on the Eastern Front since when?
1941. Okay. So what you've got then, though, is that the British are saying, but we don't want to open a second front in this way. So what they're really doing is using their vast naval power to help contain, blockade the Germans. And they're wanting to sort of nibble around the perimeter. So they're in favor of going into North Africa. They are in favor of going into Italy after that. As Churchill said, we're going to strike at the soft underbelly of Nazi Europe. Of course, it turned out to be, as one American said, a tough old gut. But they didn't want to open the second front, in part because they knew they didn't have the manpower. They were also afraid that it would turn into another World War I-style war of attrition, in which there would be very little movement on the battlefield. There would be thousands of men that would be lost in order to gain just yards of ground. Interestingly enough, for a short while, it did look like that on the Western Front. After Normandy, after the landing, I should say, on June 6th, the fighting in the bocage, the hedgerow, did look very much like the Battle of Attrition from World War I. It was the closest thing in World War II to the World War I fighting.
So there was trench warfare?
Well, there was warfare in that it was not very static. I mean, that it was static and that there was not a lot of maneuverability. It was taking yards at a time. And this is because of the nature of the terrain, because there are all these hedgerows. These are ancient fence lines that dot the Norman countryside. And they formed a natural barrier. So if you can think of like a long, long mound of earth, like a ridge of earth, with a very deep, old hedgerow that could be, in some cases, many feet deep. And this formed a defensive line, a perimeter, that would funnel the Allied attack into a certain field, a certain part of a field. And the Germans could be waiting and have all of their weapons trained on that entranceway to the field. And it wasn't until the Americans figured out how to cut through that hedgerow that they were able to restore a little bit of mobility to the battlefield. And then, of course, it wasn't until late July, with what was called Operation Cobra, and we can talk about that in a minute, in which there was an actual break through and then break out of the Norman hedgerow country. So for nearly 2 months, there was an advance that was almost yards at a time across the Norman countryside, and very much slowed down the advance. We tend to think of today, looking back on it, that there was D-Day, June the 6th, a landing. Then all of a sudden, Paris has taken the Battle of the Bulge and the war's over. But there was an 80-day campaign that was waged from the time that the Allies landed on June 6th all the way through until the liberation of Paris, which didn't happen until August. So it's a much longer campaign than most people realize. And really, I mean, that most of the bloody heavy fighting would occur after June the 6th, 1944.
And the Battle of the Bulge was 6 months after D-Day.
That's correct.
In December. Yeah. So the immediate objective, obviously, is to establish a beachhead in northern France. Was the objective then to drive on Paris and liberate France, or was the objective always get to Berlin?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think one that not even the Allied planners completely understood or knew. They had put so much effort into making the amphibious assault. There was less thought given to, well, what do we do once we get in here? And they had drawn a map in which they showed where they thought the front lines should be at a certain point. So by June 15, they expected to be here. By June 30, they expected to be further in. By July 15, none of that timetable worked. In fact, all of the objectives that had been set for the first day really were not taken, including Caen, which the British were supposed to have taken on the first day, and they were not even anywhere close to taking. So they had all of these lines that were set up, but there was not really a clear objective as to what would happen and how that would happen. There was a sense that they would be pushing on sort of this broad front. What eventually happened was that they had to narrow it down to a small area, punch through the German line, and at that point, that's August the 1st, Third Army goes operational. George Patton, who was the famous pioneer of maneuver warfare in the 20th century, they unleash him, and he's able to get around behind the Germans. And then that opens everything up. The German line collapses. Paris is liberated. But the objective was to sort of push the Germans back across France. Again, there's too much emphasis on taking ground and not necessarily destroying the German army. Patton understood that the German army had to be destroyed. He's held back repeatedly by Omar Bradley, who's commander of the American forces. One of the things we forget is that the overall operation, Bernard Montgomery, the British general, was actually in command of the ground forces for what was called Operation Overlord. So a British commander was in overall command of the ground forces. Now, Eisenhower is still in command of all of the Allied forces, including the air forces, going into France. But Montgomery's in command on the ground. And the British make a landing along with the Americans. So remember that there are five beaches that are assaulted, starting from west to east. You've got Utah Beach, Omaha Beach. Those are American. Then you've got Gold, which is British, Juno, which is Canadian, and Sword, which is the last one. So you've got two American divisions, two British divisions, along with three British armored brigades, and a Canadian division going in. And the Canadians make much greater progress, and the British make much greater progress than the Americans do on June the 6th. But no one reaches what was supposed to be their objective point by the end of the day.
Was the worst fighting, in fact, on Omaha Beach? I mean, we watch popular culture and media, and Saving Private Ryan, the 1998 movie, certainly focuses on what happened on that beach that morning. Pretty true to life?
It was the most difficult beach to take. Utah Beach ended up being much lighter. First of all, when the Americans landed, the 4th Infantry Division landed, they landed in the wrong place, which turned out to be a godsend. They actually landed in a place where the German defenses were even weaker. Also remember that there were three parachute divisions that had gone in the night before. Mm. So you had two American, 82nd and 101st, and then on the other end of the line, on the eastern end of the line, you've got the 6th British Airborne Division. And those paratroopers had landed, the 82nd and 101st had landed the night before, and they had cut off the bridges over the Metairie River, which prevented the Germans from reinforcing Omaha Beach. So the casualties there were relatively light. I'm sorry, Utah Beach. They were relatively light. Omaha, on the other hand, ended up being a nightmare, really. American planners had missed the fact that the Germans had reinforced the beach with a cracked unit, their 352nd Division, which was a very strong, well-trained German division. There was still the intelligence showed that there were still sort of second and third-rate German troops that were holding the lines, that most of the German strong units, the well-trained units, were still facing the Russians out on the Eastern Front. We missed that. And so when the 1st Infantry Division, the 29th Division, there was a regiment from each of those divisions. When they landed there at 0630 and the Rangers landed at Pointe du Hoc, they came into the teeth of a very, very strong and formidable German defense that just chewed them up. In fact, if you look at the German reports from that morning, they thought they had repelled the American landing. And the Americans were worried that they had been repelled. And Bradley was even considering, Omar Bradley, who was in command of the American forces, considered pulling the men off the beach and then maybe landing someplace else, that it just wasn't getting there. Part of the problem was that that morning there was a very short bombardment. In the Pacific, the Americans had learned that you needed to bombard several days in advance in order to soften up a position. The Americans on D-Day only bombarded for several hours. What they were trying to do were two things that simply are incompatible: to achieve tactical surprise and overwhelming firepower. So you're trying to go in early that morning and achieve a tactical surprise. Well, you can't bombard for days before that and achieve a surprise.
You give yourself away.
Right, and that allows the Germans to reinforce. The problem with not bombard, they didn't bombard long enough. So really, they didn't do either one. The Germans figured out they were coming. They had a couple hours to figure it out. And they did not destroy the German defenses. So the landing goes in. First, second, and third waves go in. The DD tanks, these are the amphibious tanks that were supposed to land with the infantry. Most of them ended up being swamped. Very few of them got into the beach. Very little of the artillery got into the beach. So what you ended up with was basically infantrymen on the beach without any kind of support in terms of artillery or tanks. The air cover that was supposed to have been provided, the Allies sent in their bombers to bomb the beach, but there was a very heavy fog that morning. Most of the American planes held their bombs until they knew they were inland so that they wouldn't hit their own men, but they held it for too long. And so they ended up killing a lot of French cows, but they really didn't kill very many German soldiers. So the beach was not cratered in the way that they thought it would be. They thought there might be shell holes in the beach to protect the infantry, that they'd have a place to find shelter on the beach. No tanks get in. No artillery gets in. Fortunately, some of the naval officers who were in command of destroyers brought those destroyers in close enough to provide some kind of naval gunfire support for the infantry. The plan was to make a frontal assault right into the German defenses. The men on the beach threw the plan out, improvised once they got in, and realized that what they needed to do was to attack between the strong points and go up the draws, up these ravines, and then come around behind the German pillboxes and take them from the rear where they were weaker. So as Stephen Ambrose says, it really wasn't a miracle that won D-Day. It was infantry. It was really an infantry battle, which is hard to imagine when you think about what we were up against. But there simply wasn't the support that should have been there. Everything was going wrong that morning on Omaha Beach.
Which leads me to ask you, if we back up just a minute, two questions that I want to ask. First of all, why did they choose those beaches? Looking at a map of Europe, if you're going to make an invasion in order to liberate Europe, why do you choose those beaches? Number one. Number two, didn't the Germans know they were coming in there? I mean, was there really such a thing as a tactical surprise in 1944? Did they really not know where and when it was coming?
Well, they didn't. And the beaches were chosen because we had learned a lesson. We, the Allies, had learned a lesson. We thought initially that if we were going to make a landing, we needed to come in at a port. But Dieppe in 1942 showed that that was simply impossible. You can't make an amphibious assault into a port. You need to come into a beach where it's flat. The only place that was even viable along that coast was going to be Normandy. The Germans and some of the Allies initially thought that it would come at the Pas-de-Calais, which is the narrowest point of the channel. So basically, that's across from Dover, England, at the mouth of the Seine River. And they thought that that would be where the assault would come, and the Germans were really holding many of their troops, which would be northeast of the Normandy beaches. But they did not know where it was going to happen. And part of this was part of the deception that had taken place. So prior to D-Day, there was a fight between those who were the champions of ground forces and the air forces as to exactly how would this be done. Bomber Command wanted to bomb Berlin, draw all of the German planes into Berlin and the German countryside and the German cities. Eisenhower, though, made a point and won his point that what they nearly needed to do was to bomb all of the French transportation system, railroads, transportation hubs, in order to cut off the beaches so that the Germans could not readily reinforce. But in order to do that, to not give away the fact that Normandy was going to be the assault point, they had to basically bomb all along the French countryside from the Pas-de-Calais all the way down into the Cotentin Peninsula, which below Cherbourg, without so that there wasn't any sense of exactly where was the attack coming. It had to happen on those beaches. It was the only place where it was wide enough and there was enough support in terms of the sand to support these heavy tanks and coming across the beach. But that meant because of the German defenses, all these hedgehogs and hedgerows that had been set up in terms of anti-tank and anti-ship defenses that had been placed, it meant that you couldn't come in at high tide. They had to come in at low tide so that they could get around them. So that also restricted the days in which this could occur. So you had to have low tide, you had to have good weather, which meant that there were only a few days early in the month when this could occur. The Germans were looking for something in late May and early June, but by the time early June came, the weather was so foul. They were on ready alert in late May. But by the first part of June, the Norman coast, the whole entire French coast, in fact, was being lashed by a terrible storm. So the Germans thought, well, they're not coming now. They waited during late May. Nothing happened. They're not going to come now. Rommel goes home to celebrate his birthday. Many of the other generals disappear. Everyone stands down. But Eisenhower gets the word that there's going to be one day, there's going to be a window between these two fronts coming through. And that's going to be June 5th, sometime between June 4th and 6th, when this could actually happen. There's low tide. There's an opening between this bad weather. And that's when it's got to happen. So there's this famous scene in which they argue and they talk about, should we go, should we not go? Finally, Eisenhower says, let's go. So the Germans didn't know exactly where they were coming. They knew it would be on the French coast, but they still thought it was going to be the Pas-de-Calais. The other thing that threw the Germans off was that there was another deception in that an entire fictitious army was built around George Patton. The Germans knew that Patton was really the best Allied commander. They thought he would be given the real invasion. And the Allies brought him from Sicily, put him into a headquarters in England, and built a fictitious army with dummy tanks, dummy trucks, all kinds of fake radio traffic, all in order to deceive the Germans into thinking that there really was going to be this massive army. So even once the Americans and the Allies came into Normandy, the Germans were still confident that the real attack was going to come at the Pas-de-Calais and it was going to be delivered by Patton, that this thing in Normandy was just simply a diversion to draw troops away from the real landing point. So they really didn't know what was going on. And all of it was compounded by the fact that you had a difference in how the assault should be met. So overall command of the Germans is under von Rundstedt. Army Group B is under command of Rommel. So Rommel's got control of the beaches. Von Rundstedt said, let's hold back our panzers, let's let the Allies land, and then what we'll do is we'll go in and we'll push them back into the sea. Rommel knew because the Allies had clear air superiority because of the planes that we had that could destroy these tanks. He said, we've got to meet them at the beach. We've got to push them into the sea. We cannot let them make a lodgment. If they do, it's just a matter of time because of their superior air. So you had this disagreement, and then on top of it, and this is really the crazy part, Hitler decided that he was going to be the one that would decide when the reserves could be used. He decided to go to bed on the night of June the 5th. He went to sleep. He had taken sleeping pills. No one wanted to wake him up that morning on June the 6th in order to release these reserves so that they could at least try to do what Rommel was saying, which was to launch this massive panzer counterattack, and push the Allies back into the sea. Eventually, some of the German panzer reserves were released, but they ended up driving in more into the British lines. In fact, the British and the Canadians were almost completely separated by a panzer attack, which was pushed back. So there were a lot of things that conspired against the Germans during all this, including Hitler himself, who was not going to allow his generals to be able to have control over the battlefield.
And let's get up to the 10,000-foot level for a minute. Is it safe to say that if the Americans had succeeded in forcing Britain or coercing Britain to do a landing in 1942, they would have faced a much different German army than they faced in 1944? Is it safe to say that the Russians had pretty much worn down the cream of the German army by 1944?
Well, remember that the Germans had not only been destroyed pretty much by the Russians, but that we simply were not ready in 1942. If we had gone into Europe in 1942, there really was not the landing craft. There really were not the airplanes at that point. You think about how massive this operation was. There were 12,000 airplanes that of some shape and form, landing planes that dropped the airborne. There were gliders, as well as fighters and bombers. Then you've got 7,000 naval ships, 4,000 landing craft of some sort or support ships. You've got 155,000 troops that are going to be landed. We could not have pulled this together in 1942. And even if we had been able to pull that together logistically, the army was simply not ready. And we found that out when we went into North Africa. One of the services that the British did provide to us, one of the good things they did for us, by forcing us to delay this landing, they gave the Americans a chance to be bloodied, to actually get some experience. That first battle that we were in at Kasserine Pass in North Africa in early 1943, we got our tails kicked by Rommel. And it was a real learning experience for the Americans. It was a wake-up call. We had to learn how to do things differently. We had to learn how to get different armor onto the battlefield. So North Africa, and then Sicily, and then Italy all gave us a chance to sort of work out the kinks, so to speak, to give us some experience on the field so that once we were ready to go in terms of logistically ready to go into Normandy, and we got the British to agree to it at that point, we really had the experience we needed. So the Russians had pretty much destroyed much of the German army, and they were holding most of the divisions on the Eastern Front that could have been released to come west. And we got a lot more experience that we needed, and we had time to build up logistically so that when we actually went in, we were really ready to go in.
So two questions about logistics. First of all, you mentioned going from east to west, or from west to east, from Utah Beach over to Sword. First of all, those are not French names. Those beaches are not literally named Omaha Beach. That's a name that the American military put on that.
Well, the Allies. I mean, those were code names for each beach that were used just for this operation. No, those are not the official names of the beaches. They all bear, I guess, the names of the towns that are nearby there. So,
and they're all near Normandy, I take it.
They're all in Normandy. Yeah. They're all Norman beaches. Yes.
How wide was this front, roughly? Do you know what we're talking about, from Utah over to Sword?
That I do not know off the top of my head, but it was much wider. It's interesting because that front was much wider and the beaches were much deeper than we tend to think. When we see it in the movie, it looks like maybe a football field. It's actually several football fields long. When you stand there today at low tide, and I've done this, you're really surprised at how far that those troops had to come across that beach. Much wider than you see in Saving Private Ryan. It's probably three or four times wider than what you see in Saving Private Ryan.
And the area that they captured that's up on the hill, that is literally where the American cemetery is now, right? Looking out over the beach.
In the movie, yeah. Well, that's it's the American cemetery is at next to a little village called Coville-sur-Mer, Coville by the sea. And it was the village that was sort of central to the Omaha Beach attack, yes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they had to get up on top of that high ground. And those draws, those ravines that I was talking about, that's how they got up there rather than just simply attacking into the German pillboxes.
You mentioned how many men were involved in this, how many troops, all the different pieces of equipment. This was, I think, the largest amphibian military operation ever. Is that correct?
Largest amphibious assault, overwater assault, up to that time. The only thing that rivaled it later would be, and there's been historians go back and forth about this, but what happened at Okinawa in early 1945 was larger in terms of the numbers of ships and the troops that were involved in it. Not much, but it was still bigger overall than what happened in Normandy. But it was certainly the largest. And really the Germans up to that point, and the Germans couldn't even imagine. They could not even imagine that the Allies could bring such power to bear. It really is pretty amazing to think about what the Allies were able to do, not only in terms of taking the beach, but this is the thing we always forget about, is we sort of focus on the infantry, we want to focus on the fighting, but all that has to take place, all the planning, all of the logistics, all of bringing all the supplies for it, all the naval ships. The naval operation had its own name. It was codenamed Neptune. It had its own operation because everything was Navy until the men got on the beach. So it had its own separate related operation. But to be able to pull all that together and to do it under a coalition, and this is part of where Eisenhower, this is where his real genius was, which was bringing all of these different countries together, bringing all these different generals. So many of these generals had their own egos, their own issues and problems, and somehow he was able to hold all this together and to get the men not only ashore, but then to break out. And as I said, that's part of the story. D-Day, June the 6th is one day. There were 79 more days after that of killing that's going to take place. Eventually, the Allies are able to push far enough inland. They capture St. Lo. And it's at this point that Bradley finally realizes that pushing on a broad front's not going to actually, they just can't keep going this way. It's a battle of attrition at that point. And no one's winning that. Everyone's being bled white. So he finally comes up with the idea that they're going to use the overwhelming American air power, and not just fighter bombers, but they're going to bring in the B-17s, the heavy bombers that had been used over Germany, and they're going to drop bombs along a seven-mile corridor along this the road northwest of St. Lo. And the bombers come in over 2 days, and they drop their payload, and it just absolutely destroys the German army. I mean, when the Germans crawled out of their holes, it was like tanks were upside down. I mean, it looked like they like toys. And the Allies finally, the Americans under the 7th Corps under General Collins was able to punch through finally. But it took someone like Patton. I mean, Bradley still focused on the breakthrough. You got to break out, though. You got to exploit that. And on August the 1st is when Patton's Third Army goes operational. And then this is what part of the Patton legend is all about. It's the fact that he attacks in three different directions. He gets around behind the Germans. He wants to go all the way to the Seine River and cut the Germans off. Bradley pulls him back. So it's a much wider flanking maneuver. And that leads then to what's called the Falaise Gap. And the last of the German soldiers, about 50,000 of them, get out. They don't get out with any of their equipment. All their tanks are destroyed. Half tracks are destroyed. Nearly 500,000 men destroyed. It really was the beginning of the end there on the Western Front. Not a completely decisive battle because Albert Speer is making all these tanks and they're able to replace all those. And Hitler's able to find some reserves by bringing up most of the old men and young boys for the Battle of the Bulge. But it does destroy the German 7th Army, and it does then allow the Allies to take Paris and to get all the way up to the French-German border.
There's a lot of different directions we could go in here. One of the things I want to talk about is after D-Day and going up to the end of the war. So the landings are on June 6, 1944, and Victory in Europe Day is May 8, 1945, really 11 months later. The Allies had been calling for unconditional surrender from the Germans. And I want you to explain what that means. And in World War I, the Germans had surrendered on French soil. So it begs the question, what I want to ask you is, was it even possible that the Allies could have accepted a German surrender while they were actually in France, if they'd been able to read the tea leaves, if they'd somehow been able to overthrow Hitler, as they tried to do in August of 1944? Could the war have somehow ended much sooner than it did without an invasion of Germany? And who knows what that would have looked like in the post-war world? But how did the call for unconditional surrender, first of all, what did that mean? And secondly, how did it change the course of the war after D-Day?
Well, it happened because Roosevelt announced it at a press conference.
Unilaterally, right?
Yeah, he caught everybody, including Churchill, off guard. They really hadn't talked about it. I don't think that Churchill would necessarily have gone at it in a different way, but it did surprise him, and it surprised the Germans, and really, in some ways, it gave Hitler and the Germans a propaganda victory because they said, okay, now we know what this is all about.
What do you mean by that? How does that work?
Unconditional surrender means that it's now going to be total war. Unconditional surrender means that there are no conditions, that the only thing that the Allies are going to accept is the total destruction of Nazi Germany, the end of the German government, the complete surrender of its armed forces, the complete overthrow of the Nazis.
Which didn't happen in World War I.
Didn't happen in World War I because there was an armistice, and the Germans simply went home. There was no surrender. They just went home. And so when they went home, it created, you know, the myth of the so-called myth of the stab in the back, which fed into what Hitler said, that the Jews had betrayed the German people, and they really hadn't lost the war. And many of the Americans, some of the British at the time of World War I, including Pershing, knew that this was going to be the great danger. The Germans were going to go home in 1918 and say, we really didn't lose this thing. And that's exactly what they did. So in World War II, there was, FDR had determined this was not going to happen again. We are not going to accept anything but unconditional surrender. So that means at that point, it is total war. Every resource is going to be mobilized now, either to defend Germany or to destroy it on the part of the Allies. And that there is no going back at that point. There can be no negotiated settlement. There can be no negotiated surrender. That Hitler is going to have to be overthrown. The German army will have to be destroyed. And the whole apparatus of Nazism dismantled.
So if I can stop you for 1 second. Then literally what that means is, let's say sometime in late 1944 without this, the Nazis may have said, we will lay down our arms, but we'll keep our government. The Nazis will stay in power, and the armies will stop fighting.
Conceivably.
Yeah.
On the other hand, remember that they're the Russians, and Stalin was not going to agree to that. He already was fearful of what the Germans were going to do when they went into Poland in 1939, and they basically broke the pact that they had with the Soviets. So Stalin was committed at this point to making it a total war. But there could have been a negotiated settlement in the West, and that's what some of the German officers wanted. They wanted to reach a peace with the Western Allies, with the British and the Americans, so that they could turn every effort they had back towards the Russians.
And
the
Bolsheviks. Could all fight the Russians.
They could all fight. Well, right. They certainly could say that the Germans would certainly turn that way, and they were going to fight the Russians. And that then would mean that they would be able to deal with the Russians without having to worry about what was going on behind them on the other side with the British and the Americans. There was some hope that could have happened. You know, in the middle of all of the Normandy campaign, you've got the plot against Hitler, the attempt to kill him at his in the Wolf's Lair in July of 1944.
July, yeah.
Rommel and many of the German generals are implicated in this, including Kluge. Now, Kluge had taken command of the 7th Army. He had been sent out there after. It was quite clear that Rommel wasn't going to get the job done, so Kluge is sent out, and he's implicated in all this, and he ends up committing suicide. So, and the German, you know, high command just starts, and particularly the West starts to unravel. Von Rundstedt's removed, Model is brought in to take over and take command.
And Rommel is allowed to commit suicide.
Rommel's allowed to commit suicide. And Hitler also made a huge tactical error in that he thought that once Patton had begun to break out, that they could launch an attack that would cut him off. So they would attack from east to west. They would, the German army would attack, and that they would cut off Patton's advance from the rest of the Allies at Avranches. So they launched this attack that leads to the Battle of Mortain, which is famous for the 30th Infantry Division. But it ends up, what it does is, as Patton said, they just stuck their head into the meat grinder. And once again, Hitler trying to take control of the situation, micromanaging the battlefield. And everyone knew it wasn't going to work except for Hitler. And it didn't work. It just created, it just hastened, accelerated the defeat of the German army.
So calling for unconditional surrender may have prolonged the war, but in the end it also helped destroy Germany.
It may have prolonged the war. It also helped to destroy, that's a good way of putting it, Nazi Germany. And as I said, we have to keep in mind what the Russians are doing, because while this battle is going on in Normandy, the Russians are still advancing towards Germany. They're still chewing up German units. They're still facing the vast majority of the German army. And if those units had been released, this is to me the great question was, if the Russians had been knocked out, what would have happened if all of those German divisions had been allowed to come to the West? It would have been very difficult for the Western Allies, the British and the Americans, to have defeated the Germans.
We do forget. I think American casualties in World War II numbered about 400,000, I think. The Russian casualties, I think, were in excess of 20 million.
Yes.
So they were the ones who did the bulk of the fighting and the dying, literally, to protect their homeland against the Germans. So that's an interesting point. What do you think would have happened? I mean, as long as we're playing what if, what would have happened if the Germans had succeeded in Barbarossa in knocking the Russians out and had turned their full attention to the British and the Americans?
It's likely that the Allies would have been the ones suing for some kind of a negotiated peace.
Mm. So the post-war world would have looked very different.
They would have looked very different. I think the Germans, what happened in Normandy, would imagine all of those German divisions guarding that Norman coast. It's just inconceivable that we could have managed to achieve a lodgment on June 6th.
Is it conceivable that the war might have lasted another 10 years and that the Americans would have had to sustain the will to fight? Because it's hard to believe that the United States could not have produced the manpower that it would have taken to overcome the Germans eventually.
Well, but we wouldn't have had England, because it's very likely that those German divisions that would have been that were facing the Russians would have been released. They would have been available to invade England. All the planes that were on the Eastern Front would have been available to bomb England. So you bring all the German might. Think about that. All the German might could have been brought against England. This is where Hitler made his huge mistake, was that he attacked the Russians before he had finished off the British.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, well, they're contained, they're taken care of. I'm going to go. He got impatient. If he had just taken one ally at a time, it's very likely he would have crushed them. And thank goodness that he did attack the Russians when he did. And we can't overestimate the role of the Russians in terms of winning World War II.
So it would have been up to the Americans and the Canadians, basically, at that point. So we know, of course, that it did succeed. We have often been told that June 6, 1944, was the most important day of the 20th century. It was the hinge upon which the rest of the century turned. Would you agree with that? Or is that just hyperbole?
Well,
if the Americans had been pushed back into the... If the Allies had been pushed back into the water that morning, would they have just waited another month, another week, and come right back at it?
I think they would have come again. There would have been another attempt. I'm convinced of that. I don't think that would have been the end of the attempt to make... But it would have been a while. There would have been a lot of finger-pointing, a lot of changing command, probably, all the way up even to Eisenhower. That, again, underestimates what the Russians were doing. I mean, from the Russian perspective, they would say probably it was the Battle of Kursk that was where the turning point was, or Stalingrad was the turning point. From their perspective, that's where all of it happened. So, certainly from the perspective of the Western Allies, that's where was the turning point. That was the day, and Stalin was glad that there finally was a second front. He had been begging, pushing for that. It did take some pressure off the Russians, but just to have said that would have been, if it had failed, that would have been the last attempt. I think they would have tried to come back at some point. The Allies would have come back and tried to make another attempt at it somewhere else.
To go back to the point we were previously talking about, is if the Russians had been knocked out and the Germans had been able to bring their forces to bear against the British. The other thing I think we need to remember too is that the Germans were trying to develop atomic weapons as well, were they not?
They were developing atomic weapons, and they were developing the rockets to deliver that technology. So remember the V-1 and V-2 rockets that were being launched into England, into London. That was one of the reasons why Montgomery eventually ended up getting more of the supplies than Patton did, because the British were going to try to clear the French and Belgian coast to get those and attack those V-1 and V-2 rocket sites that were causing all the civilian casualties.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the Germans were working on an atomic weapon, and moreover, they had already developed the rocket technology that would allow them to have delivered a nuclear warhead into England.
So if D-Day had failed, if the Russians had been less successful, we would have been looking at a nuclearized Nazi Germany. And then
yes,
all bets are off as to what happens at that point.
Yeah, interesting to think about. Thank goodness it's not the way it played out.
Of course, the way it did play out is the Russians got the weapons, and there we still are. Which leads me now to my last point, and really, talk about what is the significance of D-Day. Looking back at it now from 75 years, What's the significance of that day and the Allied victory in that war?
Well, D-Day is significant long-term in that it ensures that the Americans are going to be one of the major powers that wins World War II. We are going to be in Europe. I mean, if you think about it, what happens is that no European power wins World War II. It ends up being two non-European powers. It ends up being the Russians and the Americans. They are the victors. And it gives those two countries a major dominating presence in Europe. And they dominate the peace in terms of how it's going to be established. And that sets the fault line then for what's going to come in terms of the struggle, the Cold War struggle between communism and freedom, capitalism, whatever you want to call it, the free West. It sets up that confrontation then in terms of where that division is going to be. So it's interesting that the last major war that has been fought in Europe, because we've had peace for 75 years now, 74 years now, the victors are not European. The victors are the Americans and the Russians.
And there has been peace in Europe. Next year will be 75 years in 2020, and that's unprecedented. I mean, you have to go back, you and I were talking earlier, you almost have to go back to the medieval period to find a period of peace in Europe that lasts this long, right?
Correct. There has not been peace in Europe for as long as there has been since between now and World War II.
And do you attribute that, and now really we're speculating, but do we attribute that to international organizations like NATO and the United Nations, or is it just simply because the Cold War drew a line there, a nuclear line, that nobody was willing to cross?
Yes. I think it's both of those. I think, let's put it this way, we will never know for certain why these things have not happened. I mean, some kind of a cause and effect, but the fact is that there has been peace in Europe now for nearly three quarters of a century, which has been unprecedented. And we have had a United Nations, we have had a NATO, and we have had victors in Europe that drew lines that were very different, and attention immediately went towards the Cold War, which of course would mean if that Cold War went hot, then that was going to be nuclear annihilation. As you said, no one really wanted to cross that line. So I think all of the above would certainly play a huge factor in that. And those alliances that we've created, which makes us wonder about where are things going now with the reawakening of nationalism in Europe and other countries, with questioning whether these alliances really matter anymore to the peace, to the United States going forward, to the European allies. It makes you wonder about all of that. And it means that we should probably tread very carefully as we move into all of this to thinking about how these things should evolve. Should they evolve? Yes. I mean, we certainly need to rethink and think about how all these alliances fit now in a post-Cold War world. But at the same time, we have to remember that there has been peace, and the one thing that we can point to is certainly these alliances that were created that ensured that there would be protection for most of Europe anyway.
So here we stand 75 years beyond D-Day, and you're a Civil War historian, and I know you've seen the footage of 1938, the 75th anniversary of Gettysburg. There were still veterans who were alive. Can you give us a ballpark? How many D-Day veterans are still alive now, and is this really the last anniversary that they'll be able to attend?
I think it's the last anniversary. How many are still around? There can't be many left when you think about the fact that they're probably in their mid-90s now, 95, 96, the youngest ones anyway. You know, I have one remaining World War II combat veteran friend, and he is not a veteran of the European theater. He is a veteran of the Pacific theater. He was a Marine, Fred Mingledorf, I'll mention his name. And he is not the last friend, the last person that I know that was a combat veteran. There are some still out there, but all of the ones that the friendships that I had built with men who had served in Europe, they have all died now. So this will certainly be the last major anniversary that we will see. Many of them have gotten where, you know, they can't even go and attend their own reunions anymore, let alone go to Normandy. Mm-hmm. So we certainly have seen the last. We will continue to mark this anniversary. We will continue to commemorate what happened and understand what happened. Certainly the people in Normandy will for many years to come. But like so many other things, you know, memory, all of that will fade with time as time goes on. But I think the lasting memorial to that is the free Europe. What we have today in terms of freedom in Europe, that's the greatest memorial. That's the greatest tribute. If you think about it, that's what this was really all about. That's why it happened, was for us, where we are today.
And that's a fitting end to this. Thanks so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.